Castaño, con su equipo de colaboradores periodistas del colectivo de comunicación Radicales Libres. Silvia Oviedo.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
My expertise, as you know, is CIA, Marine Corps, three CIA secret wars. I had a position in the National Security Council in 1975 as the chief of the Angola task force running the secret war in Angola. It was the third CIA secret war I was part of. The national security law creating the National Security Council and the CIA, as you know, was passed in 1947. The CIA was given this charter to perform such other duties and function as might be necessary to the national security interests, and given a vague authority to protect its sources and methods. And I think it was in the mid-80s that I coined this phrase, the Third World War, because in my research I realized that we were not attacking the Soviet Union and the CIA's activities, we were attacking people in the Third World. And I'm going to just quickly, in the interest of time, just give you a little sense of what that means, this Third World War. Basically, it's the third, I believe, in terms of loss of life and human destruction, the third bloodiest war in all of history. They undertake to run operations in every corner of the globe. They also undertook the license of operating just totally above and beyond U.S. laws. They had a license, if you will, to kill, but also they took that to a license to smuggle drugs, a license to do all kinds of things to other people in other societies in violation of international law, our law, and every principle of nations working together for a healthier and more peaceful world. Meanwhile, again, they battled to convert the U.S. legal system in such a way that it would give them control of our society. Now, we have massive documentation of what they call the secret wars of the CIA. We don't have to guess or speculate. We had the Church Committee investigate them in 1975, gave us our first really in-depth, powerful look inside this structure. Senator Church said in the 14 years before he did his investigation that he found they had run 900 major operations and 3,000 minor operations. And if you extrapolate that over the whole period of the 40-odd years that we've had a CIA, you come up with 3,000 major operations and over 10,000 minor operations, every one of them illegal, every one of them disruptive of the lives and societies of other peoples, and many of them bloody and gory beyond comprehension almost. Extensively, we manipulated and organized the overthrow of functioning constitutional democracies in other countries. We organized secret armies and directed them to fight in just about every continent in the world. We encouraged ethnic minorities to rise up and fight, people like the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua, the Kurds in the Middle East, the Hmongs in Southeast Asia. We have organized, and we still do, and fund death squads in countries around the world, like the Treasury Police in El Salvador, which are responsible for most of the killing of the 50,000 people just in the 80s, and there were 70,000 before that. And orchestration, CIA secret teams, and propaganda led us directly into the Korean War. We were attacking China from the islands, Kaimoi, Matsu, Thailand, Tibet. A lot of drug trafficking involved in this, by the way, until eventually we convinced ourselves to fight the Chinese and Korea. We had the Korean War, and 1 million people were killed. Same thing for the Vietnam War, and we have extensive documentation of how the CIA was involved at every level, or the national security complex, because it's a very cooperative thing, into manipulating the nation into the Vietnam War. And we wound up creating the Golden Triangle, in which the CIA, Air America airplanes, were flying in arms to our allies and flying back out with the heroin. We launched the largest, this is something that Jimmy Carter did, Admiral Turner brags about it, the operation in Afghanistan. Biggest single operation, I'm told, in the history of the CIA's secret wars. And sure enough, very quickly we produced the Golden Crescent, which is still the largest source of heroin perhaps in the world today. Trying to summarize this third world war that the CIA, the U.S. National Security Complex, with the military all interwoven in it in many different ways, has been waging, let me just put it this way, the best heads that I coordinate with studying this thing, we count at least minimum figure 6 million people who've been killed in this long 40-year war that we've waged against the people of the Third World. These are not Soviets. We have not been parachuting teams into the Soviet Union to kill and hurt and maim people, especially not since 1954, when they developed actually a capability of dropping atomic weapons on the United States. They aren't British, French, Swedes, Swiss, Belgians. We don't do bloody, gory operations in the countries of Europe. These are all people of the Third World. They're people of countries like the Congo, Vietnam, Kampuchea, Indonesia, Nicaragua, where conspicuously they nor their governments do not have the capability of doing any physical hurt to the United States. They don't have ICBMs, they don't have armies or navies. They could not hurt us if they wanted to. There has rarely been any evidence that they really wanted to. And that, in fact, is perhaps the whole point. If they had ICBMs, we probably wouldn't have done the things to them for fear of retaliation. Cheap shots, if you will, killing people of other countries of the world who cannot defend themselves under the guise of secrecy and under the rubric of national security.
Good evening, friends and comrades. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. And that was John Stockwell, a former CIA agent who defected from the agency at the in the late 1970s and basically blew the whistle on the operations that they were engaged in around the world, from supporting dictators, death squads, overthrowing sovereign governments, and once again engaging in some of the most bloodiest, goriest counterinsurgency and really terror operations in recent living memory. That's really what the CIA is all about. It's about destabilizing those political forces and those governments that the United States and ultimately the Fortune 500 want rid of. That's something I've talked about a lot on this show. And it really comes down to this. You know, and of course I had Brendan Campisi on last week. We talked about the history of colonialism in Canada, what was done to Indigenous people by the forces of settler colonialism, and how the British Empire really triumphed in this country, and the spirit of the British Empire has never left this place. And we are still dealing with a legacy of imperialism in this land that still leaves very, very deep scars and continues to inflict crimes upon Indigenous people and other oppressed peoples in this land itself, let alone around the world. But what it really comes down to is that imperialism is the fundamental fact of our age. It's the fundamental fact. It's the underpinning reality of the modern world. It characterizes the world in which we live. It dominates the way nations and economies interact. It is the elephant in the room at international summits and United Nations Security Council meetings. As Lenin correctly pointed out more than a century ago, in the midst of World War I, you know, a murderous clash between rival imperialist powers resulting in tens of millions of deaths. In the midst of World War I, he described imperialism as the highest stage of capitalism, and that it was not a policy. Imperialism was not a policy, but a system. A global system, a structure of how the world operates. And imperialism is the structure of the modern world. It's the structure of the modern world. And it is for a very fundamental reason. Global capitalism requires constant expansion. It requires new markets and new resources. As Michael Parenti says, a no-growth capitalism is a contradiction in terms. Capitalism must grow, and that growth must be secured by any means necessary, even if that includes the use of things like deadly airstrikes on sovereign independent states, military invasions and the destruction of whole countries, crippling economic sanctions against whole nations and peoples in efforts to coerce them, death squad terrorism and mass repression of entire populations, and the list goes on. The American Empire, as the standard bearer and enforcer of the global capitalist system all around the world, will effectively do anything to preserve and expand the profits of the Fortune 500. It is the guarantor of their profits. So independent states such as Syria that try to maintain sovereign control over their economies, their own national economies for the benefit of their people, they're obstacles to the expansion of multinational capitalist profits and are therefore targeted for destruction. Indigenous peoples such as the nation struggling to block the expansion of the Kinder Morgan pipeline in BC are obstacles to the expansion of multinational capitalist profits and are therefore targeted for repression by the state. From the murder of Indigenous land defenders blocking the expansion of Canadian mining interests in Honduras and Indonesia, to the invasion and devastation, utter devastation of the sovereign states of Libya and Iraq by coalition forces, capitalism and imperialist violence are inseparable today. They go hand in glove all around the world. And the imperialist efforts to keep the Middle East in particular safe for the Fortune 500 have been immensely bloody in recent decades. And I want to stress that the apartheid state of Israel plays a major role in this bloody process that includes the settler colonial occupation of Palestinian land, as much as it involves the murderous efforts to topple sovereign states like Syria, Iraq, Libya, Iran, and Yemen. The fact that the United States and its allies are occupying almost one-third of Syria's land area, including its main oil fields, is no accident. It's also no accident that when Israel launches more than 70 missiles against targets in Syria on a single night, on May 9th, 2018, and strikes Syria repeatedly over the past several years under the ludicrous claim of self-defense against the Iranian forces that are supposedly present in that country, it does so not as a rogue regime, but as a vital linchpin of an American empire that remains hell-bent on regime change in both Damascus and Tehran. Just as it wanted in Iraq in 2003 when it invaded, the U.S. wants a Syrian government that makes the country safe for Western investment. And the same goes for Iran. They want compliant governments there that will serve the interests of international capital, of capitalism, the global capitalist system, and will not impose barriers or national regulations or capital controls or try to maintain nationalized industries or what have you, or social programs. They want countries that are completely open to capital penetration and exploitation of their land, labor, and resources. So it's no surprise that the Western media, you know, the same corporate media that cheerleaded the massive U.S.-led assault on Syria last month on the spurious basis of responding to a chemical attack that almost certainly never even took place, has swallowed Israel's claims of responding to Iranian aggression, quote-unquote, in Syria, hook, line, and sinker, and defending Israel's supposed right to self-defense, when the Syrian army, quite rightly, retaliated with missile strikes on Israeli military positions in the occupied Golan Heights. And the media even went so far as to claim, without evidence, that the retaliatory strike came from Iranian forces rather than the Syrian military. Indeed, Western leaders such as French President Emmanuel Macron have even blamed Syria and Iran for the incident and for, quote, escalating the situation, while failing to utter a single word in condemnation of Israel's repeated acts of aggression against its neighbor, or its continued and illegal occupation of Syrian land in the Golan Heights, which it's been occupying illegally since 1967. There is no country, not even the United States, that actually recognizes Israeli occupation of the Golan. And Israel has been using that as a base to attack Syria. And once again, you know, certainly the leader of France saying these things, it comes as no surprise, as France, which is the former colonial power in Syria, before it was driven out in 1946, France would love to have a slice of the pie in the aftermath of any kind of regime change operation. And certainly the French oil giant Total got itself a substantial chunk of the Iraqi pie, of the Iraqi oil industry, after the 2003 invasion. Even if they didn't participate in the initial invasion, the French sure as hell played ball with the American Empire afterwards when it came to carving up Iraq and divvying up the oil wealth there and getting access and, basically going in, setting up shop, exploiting those natural resources and getting them to market. France was there. Total was there just as ExxonMobil was there and BP was there. But going on and continuing to talk about Israeli aggression against Syria. The unsubstantiated claims that Israel killed a dozen or more Iranians in the missile strikes it launched this week conceal the truth that the strikes on May 9th actually hit Syrian targets and killed Syrian people who were very rightfully defending their country against external aggression. According to the Russian Defense Ministry, just as in the case of the American-led missile strikes on Syria 1 month ago, which I've talked about on the show and which France and Britain also participated in, more than half of the incoming Israeli missiles were actually shot down by Syrian air defense forces, with at least four soldiers of those air defense forces giving their lives in the process. And there's definitely this one very notable instance of bravery in these from a member of the Syrian Air Defense Forces, Lieutenant Colonel Ayham Hashem Habib. He was commanding a Pantsir S-1 air defense system outside Damascus, and he was killed when an Israeli missile struck his unit. And in the video of the missile strike, you know, the video was released by the Israeli military and shot from the point of view of the incoming missile itself, you know, from a camera which I guess was inside the nose of this missile coming in, so you're basically seeing it from the missile's point of view. And in this video, you can actually see Habib, Lieutenant Colonel Habib, running toward the point of impact and deliberately taking the full blast of the exploding missile to protect his men. You know, and dying, giving his life to protect his men, like his fellow soldiers. And none of his fellow soldiers actually died as a result of, basically through his heroic efforts, sacrificing himself to protect his fellow soldiers. And the following is actually you're really not going to get this in the media, in the mainstream media, that's for sure. The following is a blow-by-blow report of the Syrian army's defense against the Israeli assault on southern Syria, missile attacks on southern Syria on the night of May 9th and the early morning of May 10th, which stands as the biggest Israeli attack on Syria since the Lebanon War in 1983. And it actually comes from the Syrian Arab Army's Facebook page. So I'll quote this. Quote, late on the evening of May 9th, the Zionist military conducted a number of artillery strikes against a Syrian army post in Khan Arnabiya, which led to SAA, Syrian Arab Army, returning fire by firing a number of mortars against the source of Zionist fire. The enemy did not stop its attack and launched a number of reconnaissance drones to sweep the borders over the airspace of the occupied Golan Heights without entering Syrian airspace. The enemy brought a Merkava tank then, which fired six random shots into Al-Bath City in Al-Kunitra, which led to SAA tank hunters dealing with the situation according to the rules of engagement. The enemy then fired a long-range standoff missile into Damascus International Airport, which was intercepted and destroyed by the Syrian air defenses 30 kilometers southeast of Damascus. The Syrian 7th Division was given an order to strike four Zionist military positions inside the occupied Golan Heights with a barrage of 40 rockets, which were fired at the Zionist military installations. The Zionist Air Force quickly escalated the situation by launching several long-range standoff missiles at a number of Syrian targets in and around Damascus and three targets in the province of Homs. The Syrian air defenses foiled the first three waves of attacks by the Zionists, which forced the Zionists to resort to surface-to-surface missiles, ground-launched surface-to-surface missiles. After the Zionists' third wave of missiles, the Syrian 7th Division was given another order to launch a barrage of 20 missiles at Zionist military positions in the occupied Golan Heights. The number of Zionist war jets participating in the missile attack on Syria was 30 jets, all of which fired their missiles from outside the Syrian, even Lebanese airspace, and did not dare to enter either. The Zionists then launched a fourth wave of missiles combined with decoys in an attempt to mislead anti-aircraft fire. They also launched surface-to-surface and air-launched long-range missiles. And this was the wave. Four missiles in this wave actually reached their targets and were not shot down and successfully hit a Syrian air defense radar site and in Syrian air defense short-range defense battery and two ammunition depots. No long-range surface-to-air missiles were fired at the Zionist jets, even though they were in range multiple times. And that, of course, was a decision made by the Syrian command on the basis of the rules of engagement. And to our knowledge, the majority of the Syrian missiles fired at the Zionist locations reached their targets. Syrian casualties were three martyrs. And with all due respect to all Syrian allies, the entire situation was dealt with by the Syrian Arab Army and under the command of the Syrian army. So the Iranians were not involved in the entire thing, needless to say. This was the Syrian army, this basically defending, doing its job, defending the sovereign nation of Syria against aggression from Israel in the biggest attack launched since 1983. And just as the Syrian army had absolute right to defend itself against the more than 100 missiles that were launched against it by the United States, France, and Britain last month, they had the absolute right to defend themselves against the Israeli missiles launched at them on May 9th and May 10th. I mean, the Syrian people and army are struggling to preserve their sovereignty. As I've said in previous episodes of this show, that is something that deserves support. That is something that should be supported by the anti-war movement in Western countries. The anti-war movement should be doing its job and basically opposing all attempts by Western governments, by the forces of imperialism to intervene in Syria, to intervene in Yemen, to intervene in Iran now that Donald Trump has torn up the nuclear agreement with Iran and is increasingly threatening that country with military force. The anti-war movement, the peace movement such as it exists, and there's a lot of work to do that needs to be done to build up that movement again so there will be an effective force in imposing imperialism wherever it rears its ugly head around the world. And in defense of the national sovereignty of the nations which are targeted by imperialism. Especially if you live in an imperialist country such as the United States, such as Canada, such as Britain, such as France. These countries which do intervene in places like Syria, they intervene in places like Iraq, which intervene in Yemen, in Libya. It is your duty as a progressive person to oppose. Imperialism at every turn. And this is crucial to understand. Certainly I respect the Syrian Arab Army for successfully defending the Syrian nation from the attacks it suffered this week, and I know they will continue to stand strong. And we should be standing strong with them. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, that was Ana Suri, Ana Arabi, Syrian patriotic song. And once again, why do I play those songs here on Back in the USSR? Because, of course, I support the self-determination of the Syrian people and their government and their army in the face of Western imperialism and Israeli aggression. This is basically what I'm... This is something I've stressed before on this show, is the fact, like, even though Syria is not a socialist government, it's not like a, you know, I myself as a communist, obviously Syria is not a communist society, it's not Cuba. You know, and there are certainly criticisms that can be made from the left with regard to the Syrian government, but of course when we're talking about the defense of that, of a formerly colonized society against imperialism, this is something that progressive people have a duty to engage in. They have a duty to oppose imperialism and to defend the sovereignty and self-determination of the Syrian people, or any people who is under the, who is threatened by imperialism anywhere in the world, as I've said before. And this is especially true if you're a progressive who is also a resident of an imperialist country, as people in Canada certainly are. And that was really what our show last week here on Back in the USSR really talked about, is why Canada is a colonial, it's a settler colonial state, and ultimately it's an imperialist state. Even we really didn't get so much into that, like, you know, internationally, how Canada has played an imperialist role in the world. But of course, I'm sure we'll definitely get to that in a later show. And because, of course, it's absolutely true. If we talk about Canada when it comes to like mining corporations or backing up the U.S. in various imperialist interventions, whether that's in Somalia or whether that's in Libya or in different, you're in Yugoslavia or all these different kind of countries where Canada has been a part of this kind of these coalition forces that have gone in. You know, basically in occupied sovereign countries engaged in regime change or what have you. Canada's been right in the thick of it on multiple occasions. Now, imperialism is also evident in the way the United States blocked, I would say, a UN investigation into the deaths of unarmed Palestinian protesters in Gaza at the hands of the Israeli military snipers. This is something I've talked about on the show ever since these crimes began on March 30th. And it needs to be stressed that the reason why the United States blocks basically every single motion at the UN condemning Israel when it engages in, you know, atrocities against the Palestinian people, it blocks every single UN investigation, every single resolution condemning anything that Israel does. And the reason why it does this is to protect this vital linchpin in its imperial arsenal. That's what Israel is. It's not because Israel somehow controls the U.S. government. That's a mistake that certain commentators definitely have made recently. And it bears, you know, needless to say, that is absolutely not the case. The United States is a global empire, and Israel has always played a subordinate role in that empire. It's an integral part of that empire. It does not control that empire. And when the U.S. decides to cover Israel's ass, it does it because it's in the U.S. The U.S. government sees that in its interest to do that. It's protecting an asset, basically. An imperial asset on the ground in the Middle East, which it sees as vital to its interests. 52 unarmed Palestinian demonstrators have now been killed in Gaza since March 30th. 18-year-old Hisham Abu Okal was shot and killed on Friday by Israeli snipers. And on the same day, 40-year-old Gabor Abu Musafa died after being shot in the head. Upwards of 500 people were injured on the same day, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, with more than 6,000 being injured since the start of the Great March of Return on the 30th of March. And these demonstrations will continue until next Tuesday, when on May 15th, Palestinians will mark Nakba Day, or the Day of Catastrophe, the day when the State of Israel first colonized their lands in 1948. And also today, Saturday, Israeli warplanes struck Beit Hanun in northern Gaza with 21 missiles targeting Palestinian power generators in the same way they have been targeting over the last several years water treatment facilities and hospitals in the Gaza Strip, tightening the siege on Gaza in a further cruel effort to make the world's largest open-air prison even more unlivable. So this is what's going on in Gaza right now. This is the kind of brutal colonialism that the Palestinian people are being subjected to by Israel. You know, at the same time, Israel is engaging in aggression in Syria at the behest of the American Empire, doing the American Empire's dirty work effectively in Syria. It's also engaging in these massacres against the Palestinians in Gaza. And these two things are absolutely connected. So this is what Jewish American activist and an academic Norman Finkelstein actually had to say about this violence. You know, these Israeli atrocities against the inhabitants of Gaza, and he spoke on The Real News just this past week. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
We'll be right back. It's the Real News. I'm Aaron Maté. May 15th is the culmination of the Great March of Return, where for weeks now, Palestinians have been marching on the Gaza fence, calling for their basic rights, an end to the Israeli blockade, and the right of return to the homes from which they were expelled in 1948. Israel has fired on these protests every single week, killing at least 40 Palestinians and injuring thousands more. And here with me to discuss is Norman Finkelstein. He is the author of many books, including his latest, Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. Norman, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So talk about what's at stake with the final stage of the Great March of Return.
Well, I think the most important thing is to put the march in its historic context. 70 years ago, this coming May 15th, began the expulsion of Palestinians from what became the State of Israel. And so the beginning of the process, which is culminating this week, was the creation of the Palestinian refugee question. And 70% of the population of Gaza constituted by refugees and their children, who are also classified as refugees under the UN system. So the beginning of the process is expulsion. And a half century ago, Gaza came under Israeli occupation. And it was, from the very beginning, a very brutal occupation. The worst massacres were presided over at the time by Ariel Sharon. So now you have expulsion. On top of that, you have occupation. And then, beginning in 2006, you have the siege of Gaza, the blockade, after Hamas won the parliamentary elections. Israel, and followed by the U.S. and the EU, imposed a medieval-like siege, a blockade of Gaza, which an illegal, immoral, inhuman siege of Gaza. And then you have the expulsion, the occupation, the blockade, and then on top of that, you have these periodic massacres visited on Gaza. Since 2004, there have been not one, not two, not three, not four, not five, not six, not seven, eight massacres visited on the people of Gaza. Now, when I say the people of Gaza, you have to bear in mind more than half the population are children. They're under the age of 18. So when we're talking about an inhuman blockade, when we're talking about massacres, they're being visited predominantly on children. Well, you can imagine, it's not difficult to conceive, that when you have this process of expulsion, occupation, blockade, massacre, at some point, the place becomes unlivable. I don't mean unlivable in some sort of poetic sense. We're talking about physically. The UN consists mostly of bureaucrats, very dry bureaucrats. And they put out, on the other hand, they put out quite competent reports. And beginning in 2012, they were asking a very realistic question. Will Gaza be livable in 2020? Again, physically, biologically, medically, will it be livable? It began with a question. Then in 2015, a UN agency, UNCTAD, put out a report, and it no longer had it as a question. It said, on the present trajectory, Gaza will be unlivable in 2020. And then in 2017, the UN realized it had been overly sanguine, overly optimistic. They said that Gaza has crossed the threshold of unlivability a long time ago. Now, what does that mean practically? It means that, for example, 97% of the water in Gaza is contaminated. Every American should understand that. We had our own national outcry when the water in Flint was discovered. Well, now we're talking about a whole area Gaza, the water is contaminated. As Sarah Roy of Harvard Center for Middle Eastern Studies put it in the newest edition of her standard work on Gaza's economy. Roy is the world's leading authority on Gaza's economy. She said, innocent people, mostly children, are being poisoned by the water they drink and by the food they eat because the soil is also contaminated. So we have a situation where people are now confronted by the fact that they are, and this makes, one doesn't like to make comparisons, because then you kind of get into this comparative suffering, and nobody really wants to go down that road. But there are aspects of Gaza that are unique. And one of the aspects is, as the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, put it, they said, UNRWA is the main humanitarian organization working with Palestinian refugees. They said, everywhere else in the world, if there's a natural disaster, say a drought, or a human-made disaster, such as war in Syria, they said, it's not a great option, but people can flee. They can leave. They can move. Now, I'm not the last one to pretend that's a great option, to become a refugee, in many cases ending up in a tent in mud. But the people of Gaza don't have that option, says UNRWA. They're trapped. Now, you have to ask yourself a very simple question. What word would you use to describe a situation where 2 million people are trapped in an area that's physically unlivable? That's not my language. That's the language of the UN. They're physically trapped in an area which is unlivable and in which, to quote Sarah Roy, they're being poisoned. So, faced with that reality, the people of Gaza saw no option, because the option of using armed resistance, which was attempted several times, proved futile. They were unable to get Israel to budge at all. As a last resort, the people of Gaza organized, really en masse, grassroots, non-sectarian, to try to break through the siege using non-violent civil resistance.
And so Gazans have done what many people across the world have been claiming that they want Gazans to do over many years, which is to non-violently protest. They've been marching every single week. Children, women, normal residents of Gaza. What has been the Israeli response?
Well, the Israeli response has been, to quote Amnesty International in a recent report it issued on the situation in Gaza, they said that Israel is conducting, and I'm quoting them, Israel is conducting a murderous assault on nonviolent protesters in Gaza. It was very unusual for Amnesty. I've followed Amnesty very closely over many years. They've never used an expression like murderous assault. And even Natalie Portman, very unusual. The actress Natalie Portman, she was Alan Dershowitz's research assistant for his book, The Case for Israel. So she was pretty far over on the right-wing end of the spectrum. And she described what Israel is doing in Gaza as committing atrocities in Gaza. So the language has itself crossed a certain threshold from pretty respectable language like disproportionate force and indiscriminate force. Now the language is finally, it took a long time, but it's rising to the occasion of the brutality of the Israeli response. The interesting question, or an interesting question, is why? In part, obviously, Israel is unleashing this murderous assault on overwhelmingly nonviolent protesters to try to repress it. But there is another side. The other side is, as one of the senior Israeli officials put it in a WikiLeaks, they said, we don't do Gandhi well. And what they meant by that was, they always have a very big problem with Palestinians engaged in nonviolent resistance, because when they use or resort to their usual brutal force, it doesn't look good in the international media. And so they're constantly trying to provoke the Gazans into resorting again to armed force. That's why they're targeting the children. That's why they're targeting beloved journalists like Murtaji, because they want to enrage the Gazans. That's why they killed the Palestinian in Malaysia, the engineer. They're hoping to, he was close to Hamas. They're hoping to trigger a reaction.
There was That's why they killed a Palestinian man in Malaysia.
Right, yeah. A Palestinian engineer. Then they killed the six, they don't acknowledge it, but everybody knows. They killed the six Qassam Brigade militants a few days ago in Gaza.
Qassam Brigade is the armed wing
of Hamas. Just as they killed the six Hamas militants on November 4th, 2008, to provoke a Hamas attack, a rocket attack, so they'll have a pretext.
November 4th, 2008, by the way, which was the election of Barack Obama.
Yes.
So the world's attention was on that.
Yeah.
Which is a good segue,
That's part of the reason they're targeting them. They're desperately trying to evoke a reaction so they can come in the full force of their brutality and claim it's self-defense. I'd just like to say, it's reached such a shameless level of ridiculousness that as Hamas holds back, as Islamic Jihadi holds back, as they absorb all the brutal, vicious Israeli provocations, the New York Times weighs in and it says that the Palestinians in Gaza are posing a lethal threat to Israel. Kites. They say that the Palestinians are flying kites, which are somehow going to burn down Israel. Because Hamas refuses to fire the quote-unquote rockets, which are not even rockets, so they don't have that pretext. So the Israeli propagandists on the New York Times, like Isabel Kirshner, so now they've conjured a new pretext, these kites, which they say are going to burn Israel to the ground. They're so desperate to try to justify the tactics and the provocations of the state of Israel.
All right, so we'll pause there and we'll pick this up in part two. My guest is Norman Finkelstein, author of many books, including God.
when your children cry. Oh, I just got a why. Annie, she came from the Lavendale. The tea became a killed her family all around. Population boom, living in two rooms. Katie, she came from downtown. Game. They play the Patriots game. Freddy, he came from the Ivy Flats, tenement slums and infested with rats, sleeping on damp straw, trying not to break the law. Thomas, he came from Kilmaine in Mayo, semi-starvation was the only life you thought in that two-room shack, then jailed and let off rack. Children cry. Oh, I just got away. I look to the east, I look to the west, to the north and the south, and I'm not too impressed. Time after crime, they rape, rob, pillaged, enslaved, and murdered. Jesus Christ was their God, and they done it in His name, so He could take the blame if it's not all a game. With Bible in one hand and a sword in the other, they came to purify my land and my Gaelic Irish mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers. With their own ancient customs, laws, music, art, way of life and culture, tribal in structure. We had a civilization when they were still not under our nations. We suffer with the Native American, Indian in Asia, Aboriginal Australia, the African people with their history so deep, and our children still weep, and our lives are still cheap. You came from Germany, from France, from England and from Spain, from Belgium and from Portugal, you are the much the same. You took what was not yours, went against your own Bible, you broke your own laws just to outdo the rival. But did you ever apologize for the hundreds of millions of lives you destroyed and terrorized? Or have you never realized? Did you never feel shame for what was done in your country's name? I'm quite now, who's to blame? I'm worried it was so inhumane. And still they teach you in your school about those glorious days of rule and how it's your destiny to be superior to me. But if you've any kind of mind, you'll see that all humankind are the children of this earth, and your hate for them will chew you up and spit you out.